But we're not going to do that. We have to change our whole way of living in order to reduce dependence upon petroleum and carboniferous stuff. Our whole way of living, it cannot happen. Talk about a political revolution, that would be easy. Communist revolution would be easy compared with a social revolution that would be involved in making us into a sane species. I'm not just talking about Americans, but especially us, but not only us at all. The Italians, the French, the Germans, Japanese, all the same as we are, just a minute. So the oil, we got to have the oil. At the same time that our need for it is increasing, our ability, there's two things. One, our ability to be assured of previous sources is declining. Venezuela is a key. And secondly, the competition for oil is rising, most especially, but not only, from China. Okay? So the demand for oil, as China industrializes, India industrializes, we're talking about a third of the population of the world now. Both of them industrializing very, very, very rapidly. China, 9 to 10% a year. India, 6 to 7%. The United States, a half of India at best. The demand, the thing that demand goes up most is for oil. So it's a source, A, from the point of view of the oil companies, of profits. Don't kid yourself. It's interesting to see what the profits of the oil companies have been in this last 2 years when all hell has broken loose. They have broken all records in profits, the oil companies, okay? They love it. But it isn't just the companies. It's the countries. It's the countries' economies. So oil is now, I think, as an economic historian, I can't think of anything that's ever been as important, although there have been many things that are very important, as oil is now in terms of economic national stability.
You're listening to Dr. Doug Dowd on the history of militarism in the United States. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. We continue with the conclusion of Doug Dowd's presentation.
Yes.
I was listening to a program.
Lou, let change first. She was first.
All right. I'm probably talking about the same thing he is. EugeneDoyle.org. This man believes that if we reduce the work week to 3 or 4 days, we will stop using as much oil.
Yes, Gene. And if my aunt had wheels, she'd be a bicycle. We're talking about changing the way we live, and it's not going to happen. I mean, look what's happening in France right now.
Right.
It's moving just the opposite direction.
No, you don't.
Just forget about it. The only way that could... Go ahead.
The point that this guy was talking about is we're putting something like 38 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere every year. And he's saying that it's suicidal, maybe surreal. I don't know what word to use. To think that we can convert the oil that's in the ground right now to carbon dioxide and get away with it, it's worse than a nuclear war. He says there's no way that we can do this.
I understand that.
We're acidifying the oceans.
Our next meeting is going to be about the environment. We'll be talking about that.
I mean, but it's more than that.
Of course it is.
It's like you're talking about using oil in an economic sense, political sense. We can't use it. We cannot use that oil that's in the ground without destroying huge, huge, vast ecosystems.
I understand.
It's
that.
Just as simple as that.
I know. We're going to talk about that next time. That's what it's all about. We're going to destroy ourselves. We have, I would say that my judgment about this is that optimistically, I would say we have until 2050 to make a major set of transformations. That's the tipping point. Then we're through. That's it. It doesn't mean we're going to blow up or starve to death or strangle or whatever. It means that we can't, it's too late to do anything. That's only 45 years away. Okay? And I think that's an optimistic view. I've seen scientists' positions 20 years from now. It's too much, okay? And there's no way at all for us to to reverse what you're talking about, except to change our whole way of life. Say, those lights would have to go off, for one thing. You understand? The refrigerators would have to shut them down. We'd have to we'd forget about our automobiles. And the kinds of and windmills and so on, hooray for them. But nothing's going to work. What we have to do is not stop using oil. And also, in doing that, we have to find substitutes for it.
The figure that he gave was something like two-thirds of all oil usage is auto transportation. Two-thirds.
Yes, and then the rest of it's consumption at home and industry and so on. And we're talking about a way of life, you know. We're talking about, it's like saying we're going to cease being an industrial society, modern industrial society, where modern industrial society is a consumeristic society also. I mean, China is already a consumeristic society and so on. And we're talking, so this doesn't mean that, well, give up. What this means to me is fight harder and sooner, right away and so on. But, yes?
Why is France moving in the wrong direction?
France has a 35-hour week, and the government is trying to get rid of that. The same thing is true in Germany. There was a big editorial about that. I mean, we make fun of them. We say, what's the matter with those people? They're just lazy fools. They want to sit around and go on vacations all the time. In fact, I'm the last person in the world to idolize Europe, but there is a certain set of traditions in Europe. Or to put it differently, there is no set of traditions in this country. That's the problem. Okay? We don't have any traditions. We have been motivated as a people, not all of us, only most of us, and the ones who have become most powerful because they've been motivated this way, to try always to have more of whatever it is we want. Money, power, things, okay? This is something that's in our blood. And you have to fight not to do it, not to want it. You have to say to yourself, I don't want it. Okay? This American characteristic is spreading over the world now like a plague. Okay? It's in Italy, I know, with respect to almost everything, and this is in France and so on and so on. But there's still something holding back in Europe, in Western Europe, most especially, but not only in Western Europe, and not only in Europe. And that is to say, there's always been a way of life which has been different from this. We have, as a people, the people of the United States, have no history that isn't modern history. You understand? We're the only people in the whole world who have no pre-modern history except our ancestors. So there are no brakes on our automobiles, so to speak. All we do is high speed. We don't know how to stop. And this is what the United States has become, in some sense or another, the symbol, the essence of what it means to be a modern society. And it's all crazy. It's dangerous as hell, and it's idiotic. Paul Perron put it so well in one very brief sentence, and you know I never put anything in a brief sentence, even in a brief paragraph. I've said it over and over again to you because, and I say it everything I write, because it's so succinct and so right. Modern capitalism teaches us to want what we don't need and not to want what we do. Period. Now, he wasn't saying that to be cute. Modern capitalism teaches us to want what we don't need and not to want what we do. So we go crazy to get this, that, the other, TV, da-da-da-da, this kind of a watch and then a better watch and then a better, this, better, a different, everything always new, novel, and function, we don't give a shit about function. What we give a shit about is appearance and fashion, being part of the cranium. Veblen had this over a century ago, conspicuous consumption. Yes.
Regarding what you were saying about American lack of interest in natural resources in Vietnam during the war, I've seen claims that the United States did have some interest in the natural resources, things like rice and rubber and tin and tungsten. And supposedly, the world's largest known deposits of tungsten ore are located in North Vietnam near the Chinese border. And tungsten is important for making things like tool steel and armor plate,
yeah, okay.
Stuff like that. Was that a factor in the war?
Well, a factor, okay. Let's say there were 24 things. That was one of them. But it was down on the list. It was like number 23. The big thing was France. The big thing was the United States wanted to get agreements from France with respect to Europe. You understand? We were planning. In 1943, 1944, we began to plan for the post-World War era, okay? We began at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire, okay? That's where the IMF, the Monetary Fund, and the World Bank were created, during the war, okay? We had our plans for what would become, finally, what we call the United States of Europe. We were planning that a long time ago, okay? And by the time the war ended, we were saying, okay, the United States went on all of these, went through all of these really necessary, decent, useful policies of trying to help Europe reconstruct. We gave them a lot, just a second, we gave them a lot, we loaned them some stuff, and so on, very bitter, big loan to Britain, which allowed us to take over Israel, incidentally, among other places. We did a lot, we helped to feed, we helped, and so on and so on. We brought the United Nations into being and used the United Nations for those purposes. But any nation that wanted to join the Marshall Plan had to join NATO, understand, which is a military organization. Every nation in one thing was in the other thing. And we're talking about 1948, 1949, right in there, okay? Yes?
How about the hypothesis that the larger cause was the Cold War itself, in the sense that they wanted it to run for the entire duration of the Soviet Union, and that Vietnam was 10 years well spent as far as they were concerned. Their biggest threat to the current capitalist establishment on the planet came with the end of the Cold War and the possible peace dividend, and they had to stoke up the war on terror in order to have a new enemy so they can have another 50-year war.
Well, I think that the terrorist thing is first place, the Bush administration did not create Al-Qaeda. It preceded the Bush administration. You know that, of course.
Well, I don't agree. George Bush Sr. had quite a lot to do with the creation.
I said the Bush administration, meaning the George W. Bush administration. No, I know that you go back, in fact, you go back to the Carter administration if you want to get the beginnings of the United States beginning to fumble its way into disaster in the Middle East. It was under Carter, President Jimmy Carter, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, whatever he won from the Nobel Prize people, who intervened in Afghanistan and created the Taliban. It was our policies that created the Taliban. And we did it quite deliberately on the advice of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has admitted publicly that we do this. We arm these people, okay? And the Russians will have to come in, and it will be, and these were his words, their Vietnam. Okay? Okay?
This supports the hypothesis that we wanted a Cold War.
Well, of course, the Cold War. We invented the Cold War, not the Soviet Union. Now, I am not a sucker for the Soviet Union. Okay, I was never took any public positions against it. I'm talking about now the 30s and the 40s and so on. But I never was a lover of it. Okay, what I was is a critic of the United States for making it almost impossible for the Soviet Union ever to become the kind of society it could have become. Okay. It isn't as though they started out with this foul dream or something like that. It's that the Soviet Union, from the time it came into being, even before that, was under attack. Okay, it was under attack. And it was under siege. There was no way for the Soviet Union, a backward country, a backward imperial power, imperialized power, I should say, there was no way for them to gain strength except through some kind of social cooperation, political cooperation, not only within their country, but between themselves and others. And they got nothing but invasion. Immediately after the war, as you know, there were troops from the so-called allies, including the United States, troops in what became the Soviet Union, and so on. And from that point on, they were always under one kind of attack or another. And somebody like Stalin had the opportunity, anytime he wanted to point to what was being done to defend his own policies of urgency. And so urgency and disaster in one corner to another. The Soviet Union never had a chance. It never had a chance to even try. And we did everything you could to see that China would never have a chance to try. And Mao cooperated with us in that. You understand? I mean, the kind of... I was... In a book I wrote in 1974, I said very good things about Mao, okay? Because he was trying to do good things. And I know Chinese people today, one person in particular, who looks back upon what Mao was trying to do on one side as being something we should try to bring back together. And there are a lot of Chinese who are trying to do that. But what Mao was trying to do and how he tried to do it are two things, okay? And how he tried to do it was disaster. And the disaster, however, wouldn't have been there had it not been for the endless, deep animosity and dangers coming from the United States. Okay, I mean, what we had did, and we've done, we're doing the same thing with the jihad. The jihad, the whole Muslim, fundamentalist Muslim movement, is a response to the kind of the modernization of the world. Now, there's no reason in the world why the world, no reason at all, the world can't have Christianity, Judaism, atheism, Muslim, Islam, everything. You know, there's no reason at all. But when people feel under pressure, then people who are very strong-minded begin to become feasible, popular, and so on. Desperation leads to them. Desperation lies behind terrorism. Desperation lies behind fundamentalist Islam. And it isn't to say it's our fault. It's to say it wouldn't have happened probably without the kind of world that we have created, which is a world for capital, period. A world for capital.
Hmm? Why would it not be our fault?
Because there are other things involved. I'll go along with you. I'm angry as hell too, but I'd say it's more complicated. It's our fault in the sense that we were one very important factor in a very large, a multiple set of factors. But I don't want to get into discussions of Islam really and beyond this. Yes.
Something. Can I ask you a question about the last thing you said? Do you think desperation underlies the establishment of fundamentalist Christianity in this country?
Pardon?
Desperation is underlying
the. I would say so, but I don't want to get into discussions of religion beyond a certain point. I could go on for days about it, but I don't want to. Let's say we could do something which we can't do. We set aside the environmental problem, okay? And just ask, what would China mean if it weren't for the fact that they're adding their own weight. They're becoming another USA, okay, in terms of environmental damage. It's already terrible over there. Set that aside and ask, what is the world likely to be like without that problem with respect to China? Well, nobody can predict this kind of thing, but I would say that, for one thing, within 20 years, China will be the largest, the most powerful economy in the world. Most powerful, not just in terms of how much it's producing, not per capita, but gross growth, but also most powerful in terms of its control over what's happening to its own economy, because they have control. No other country has anything like control over their economy the way that China does. So what China promises to be, promises setting aside economic catastrophe and, for the moment, my moment here, setting aside an economic catastrophe that has to do with financial collapse of the world, which I think is likely to happen. Okay, setting those things. And then China, I think, has the economic possibilities, the best economic possibilities of any country in the world. Then the question is, what's going to happen politically in China, which is a very much more interesting question and very much more problematic. And I've been paying pretty much closer attention to this as each month goes by. It seems to me that that really is unpredictable, because there is growing, substantial already, but growing unrest, popular unrest in China. And when you say popular, you're talking about 1.3 billion people. So you say that the poor people are showing unrest, you're talking about 500 or 600 million people are showing unrest, okay? At the same time, China has the tightest government of any place in the whole goddamn world. They really have a functioning authoritarian government, really functioning. Okay? But that government itself is split. It isn't split into left and right. It's split into left, middle, and right. Okay? There's the left, what I will call the left, and what some of the Chinese are themselves calling that, are those who want to go back, who want to maintain industrialization, but they want it to be Mao Zedong-ized, so to speak. They want it to be made so that it serves the people. They want to go back to guaranteed education, guaranteed health, guaranteed housing, guaranteed decent wages, guaranteed this, that, and the other thing. They want to have a socialist capitalist society.
Needs.
Needs, basic needs. Yeah. There's very strong feeling about that. And they have a tradition, because that's what Mao started to do. Okay? And I know one of these people pretty well now. I know his work well. I know him a bit well. And he's one of the people who's involved in that. He's in China. And his position is, okay, we may not win, but it looks possible. It looks possible. Okay? But it also looks possible to the same person and people like him that the, let's call it the right wing of China, is willing to do anything it has to do in terms of cracking down and believing that they can get away with it. And the middle doesn't know what to do. Doesn't know whether to go this way or go that way. And this is a extraordinarily dynamic moment that's going on now. It's a moment in the historic sense. It'll go on for years and years and years. Yes.
The Chinese will kill 20 million people if they need to. They don't think twice about it. They've lost 30 million in floods before.
Yeah.
And nobody even so much as shrugged their shoulders.
I don't think I'm standing here as a defender of that kind of thing.
Well, what I'm saying is, that is the question. One question was, with this 3,000-year history, might they slow down in their modernization and take this Maoist turn? And it looks to me like every element of the Chinese leadership, one thing in common, and that is they're wrong, and they're not going to slow down.
Well, that's the way it looked to me until I got to start reading about China and talking to this guy who's one of the leaders of the left in China. I think it's much more complicated than that. If I had to make a bet, and I don't like that expression, and I certainly don't want to make a bet, I would bet that things would go badly in China, okay? As I would bet things will go badly everywhere.
So badly mean a big economic stumble?
No, not so much an economic stumble, but a disaster for the people, whether it's an economic stumble or without an economic stumble. Because what has come to be the key domestically in China, not internationally, but not so far as foreign, but the key domestic question ruling in the minds of the ruling group in China is how to keep the economy growing rapidly and going always more strong qualitatively, not just quantitatively. And they've been following, so to speak, the leadership of what are called the neoliberals, and which is to say Friedmanites. But doing this within a framework, an inherited framework, which no other country has ever had. This is a country that's becoming very capitalist from a socialist, quote, socialist background. Nothing has ever happened like that before. It's always been capitalist countries some people trying to move towards socialism. Okay? So they have a socialist carpet, so to speak, they're standing on. And they're building a capitalist house around it. And the carpet, however, has got an awful lot of people in it. And now, and I don't want to make too much of this, but now the possibilities, the realities of communication in China are absolutely, totally, qualitatively different from what they were 20 years ago. The villages are no longer isolated. They're on the internet. You understand? I mean, the villagers, they have computers in the villages, and they're in contact with each other. This is something that's totally new in China. It's also... it's not so new now here, but there's a new world. There's a new world. It's growing up. And the whole thing has become unpredictable. All you can say is, well, in terms of our habitual ways of thinking about these things, it looks as though this might happen, but our habitual ways of thinking don't have these elements in it that are now becoming active elements. Then there's the foreign policy of China. The whole issue of Taiwan is so absurd, so cruel, so stupid. I mean, the people of Taiwan in the past year have made it clear in a poll, a very good poll, that they would be happy to become part of China. The people of Taiwan. It would be a popular thing to do. But the president of Taiwan, who is an American lackey, so to speak, he doesn't want to have that happen. Because then he would no longer be a lackey of anybody. He would be out on his ass. So the Chinese are not going to have anything to do with any possibility of Taiwan becoming independent. Nothing. Because independent means a colony of the United States of America. Taiwan, of course, was not originally the United States, nor was it originally Taiwan. It was Formosa. And it wasn't originally under Formosa. In Formosa, it was Japanese. And the Formosans have never really, until the modern era, I mean before the modern era, they never had the place to themselves at all. And they didn't call themselves Formosans either. So now, because of the wretched kind of history of the 20th century, now Taiwan is, so to speak, up for grabs. But up for grabs means between China and the United States. It doesn't mean anything else. And we, of course, have got Japan on our side. And if I were Japanese, I wouldn't want to be doing that. Because Japan, shall we say, awfully close to China. And China is Japan's biggest customer right now. And Japan is China's biggest customer right now. And all kinds of Japanese capital is being invested in China right now. And so that the Chinese, for the Japanese government to play footsie about Taiwan is just plain stupid. And it's going to stop sometime very soon. And I might say the United States is going to have to pull in its own tongue about this pretty soon, because the Chinese foreign policy is not unconnected with its economic policy. And China is the next biggest creditor of the United States and a very big customer. And on top of that, the biggest foreign investors in China are from the United States of America. And they don't want to have any f***ing around with the loss of their and so on and so on and so on. So the thing is extraordinarily complicated. China is totally different. I mean, people who are, like myself, economic historians and want to make generalizations from the past have got a lot of double thinking to do, because the past is gone now. The kinds of variables that are now relevant because of the world that the United States created through globalization. This is the lovely irony of the whole thing. The United States created this problem for itself. And now it talks about China, as I've said here before, as though we were back in 1890, and we're going to send the gunboats up the goddamn Yangtze if they don't bow down, you know, like this and all this sort of stuff. And it's just absolutely insane. We don't have, especially the White House doesn't have, I think most of the American people don't have, but especially the White House doesn't have any conception of the fact that China is now, what, the second most powerful country in the world? Or what? The first most powerful country in the world. It's just crazy. Okay, so the future is totally unpredictable, except to say that it's going to get worse a hell of a lot more faster than it's going to get better, yes.
But does America think it has the ultimate hammer if they control all the oil over China then? And so they're not worried about that? It may be dumb, yes.
They can't. Well, that question begs the question, because the United States cannot get control. What we're trying to do is to get control of Iraq, and we hope to be able to get control of Central Asia's oil, which is substantial. But Russia's next to Central Asia, and so is China. And so we're not going to be able to do that without a war, and with a war, we're all going to go up in flame. So there's no likelihood the United States is going to get control of Central Asia's oil. China, meanwhile, is buying up oil all over the place, buying up oil wells, buying up oil companies, and so on, as you know. So the United States it's very hard if you've been a winner all your history to learn how to not be a winner anymore. It's a whole different habit of mind, how to act, how to think, how to feel, if you don't have power over them, and we don't know it. That's why we're so dangerous. Because not only don't we know it, but we still are the most powerful military thing in the world. Okay? This is the last word.
One final question. Has America's policy in Iraq boomeranged on them? Some people I talk with say that we're not getting anything taking the oil out of there. That's all been other people say, yes, we have.
Well, what's happened is that the oil is not flowing the way it's supposed right. to, but at least down 20% from what it's supposed to be, probably much more. And there's sheer chaos, and nobody knows from day to day whether what's going to happen. So the thing is, if we went in there to be able to control the oil, that was, the assumption was that it was going to be a stabilized society. It isn't going to be a stabilized society till kingdom come. And next time, we'll be talking about the environment. And the time after that, we may still be talking about the environment, or we will be going into contemporary politics in the United States, which is very important. And then we will finish up with what we should do about it.
That was economist Doug Dowd speaking to his public class on July 4th in San Francisco. Thanks to Michael Slaughter for that recording. For more information on Doug Dowd and his work, visit www.dougdowd.org. DOUGDOWD.org. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. We'll conclude the program with two student activists doing the work of counter-recruitment. Our speakers tonight are members of the National Campus Anti-War Network, which gathered earlier this month in Chicago. The first speaker is Elizabeth Wrigley Field, a student at NYU in New York City.
The U.S. military is facing a crisis of manpower in the midst of an occupation meant to be the demonstration case for U.S. power after the Cold War. The military has been unable to meet its recruiting goals. According to Major General Michael Rochelle, the U.S. Army's recruiting commander, today's conditions represent the most challenging conditions we have seen in recruiting in my 33 years in this uniform. At the same time that recruitment has fallen sharply, a new movement has sprung up on college campuses and high schools and in communities of students and parents who are tired of being targeted for military service and are determined to get recruiters out of their schools and their neighborhoods. And this new movement has been a beacon for people disgusted by what the U.S. is doing in Iraq and is providing a new model for how the anti-war movement can reemerge as a force to end the war. And in this speech, I want to give the context that that movement is developing in. Of course, that context begins with the occupation of Iraq. The U.S. wants to control Iraq's oil to ensure a strategic advantage over its economic rivals like China. It wants to privatize the country and pave the way for U.S. companies to control the economy. It wants to establish permanent military bases in the oil-rich Middle East. And maybe most of all, it wants to send a message to the entire world that what the U.S. is, what the world's only superpower does is, says goes, and if you get in the way of the U.S., you can expect the full force of the of history's most powerful military to come raining down on your country, as has happened in Iraq. And given that these are the goals of the occupation, it is perhaps not surprising that the occupation has produced resistance from Iraqis who actually don't think that their oil should be controlled by Halliburton or their cities destroyed by U.S. bombs and chemical weapons. And this resistance has turned what U.S. politicians evidently expected to be a cakewalk into more of a quagmire, to the extent that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld made headlines a week ago by stating that the insurgency could go on for any number of years. Insurgencies tend to go on 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years. An unusually honest admission, right, from one of the most dishonest men on the planet, but evidently designed to prepare Americans for the fact that this is an occupation that they expect to continue for years and years. And that's produced a fundamental problem for the U.S. government that expected this to be their demonstration case. They must crush the resistance, but who exactly... Who is going to do that? Because when Bush and Congress say they want to go to Iraq, they don't actually mean that they personally want to go to Iraq. They actually have something different in mind. And so the task of crushing the resistance, it will have to be done by someone else. And the greatest hope of the U.S. was that by this point, the Iraqis would be doing it themselves. That's what the strategy of Iraqification is, to get one segment of Iraqis, namely the police and the military, to kill another segment of Iraqis, namely the resistance, all for the benefit of the Americans. That's the idea, but unfortunately for U.S. imperialism, Iraqification is failing, partly because large swaths of the Iraqi security forces actually have a lot more sympathy for the resistance than they do for the occupation. And that is the context for the absolute panic to sign people up for the military. Because the way that the ruling class always fights its wars is to get somebody else to do it for them. Iraqis won't do it, and so the task falls to the U.S. working class. And this is a dynamic, by the way, that did not begin with this war, but has in fact been true of every war. As the American socialist Eugene Debs wrote during World War I, "The master class has always declared the wars. The subject class has always fought the battles. The master class has had all to gain and nothing to lose, while the subject class has had nothing to gain and all to lose, especially their lives." But the only way the ruling class can get people to sign up for this is either to lie to them or to take advantage of how few opportunities our society really provides to people. In effect, our society is taking a group of people and who are being systematically denied every opportunity, told that they will never be able to afford college, they will only be able to get the most demeaning low-paid work, and they will never earn much respect. But there is a way out. They can join the military, and that's the essence of the recruiting pitch. But in truth, most of the benefits that they promise are lies. Although college money is the number one reason people sign up for military service, only 15% of soldiers wind up with any sort of college degree. And in fact, the college benefits program is the only division of the military to actually turn a profit to the tune of $72 million a year, because so many more soldiers pay money into the program than ever see anything out of it. Veterans actually earn less on average than non-veterans of comparable backgrounds do, and veterans of the Iraq War have already begun turning up in homeless shelters. But in addition to the benefits of military service, recruiters also lie about the risks. For example, a lot of recruits are being promised that they have an opt-out-of-war clause in their contract. And then when they are being shipped off to Iraq, they discover that no such clause ever actually exists. But unfortunately, while the promised benefits of military service are mostly lies, the lack of other opportunities is not a lie. I was in a meeting recently where an older man asked a bunch of high school students, "What can people like me do to inform your generation about the alternatives to military service?" And one of the students, she said, "Well, that's kind of the problem. For people from our school, there are not a lot of alternatives." But even despite that pressure on people, the military does not actually rely on students to decide for themselves whether they would like to sign up for the military. The annual recruiting budget is now $4 billion, of which $300 million is reserved for advertising, and recruiters set up at shopping malls, rock concerts, NASCAR races, beaches. They give out special video games. One of the more offensive forms of recruitment is probably the iCarumba tour, aimed specifically at Latinos. But the main way that recruiters have of reaching young people, especially high school students, is through their schools. And to quote the U.S. Army School Recruiting Program Handbook, which, that's it. This is the official handbook for Army recruiters working in schools, and it says, "The objective for military recruiters is to own the school." And the handbook offers practical advice on just how to do that, handily arranged into month-by-month guidelines. So, in August, you should contact the football coach and volunteer to assist with practice. In September, arrange to eat lunch in the school cafeteria. January is Martin Luther King's birthday, so be sure to wear your dress blues. Also, this is a quote. "Contact your first-year college students to see if they return to school. How is their second semester financial situation?" Yeah, so recruiting individual students, meanwhile, is accomplished mostly through harassment, but aided by some convenient laws. In high schools, this takes the form of the No Child Left Behind Act, which requires schools to give student contact information to the military unless their parents specifically opt out. But that act is actually just the beginning. To aid recruitment, the Pentagon is now collecting information on all high school students age 16 and up and all college students. Their database includes phone numbers, social security numbers, grades, courses taken, and ethnicity, very important for deciding whether they would like to target you. Reportedly, they have information on 12 million young people so far in this database. And it's pretty, I think, mind-boggling to think about the level of resources that go into this level of recruitment at schools that are themselves underfunded. A woman I work with in the Campus Anti-War Network, she attended a recruiting event that was also a field trip for a local high school. And at this event, the kids were playing football with professional players. They all were given personalized dog tags to take home. And they got to play on a monster truck, but apparently that was no big deal because the year before had an Apache helicopter. She also, one of the recruiters she met at this event, teaches a class in that high school called How to Get a Job in the Real World. And I will let you guess what he recommends. I think what all of this makes clear is that for working class students, and in particular for students of color, schools are not so much meant to teach kids how to think creatively or to prepare them to live a better life, but they are meant to prepare young people for their future roles. And for many young people, I think the message being sent is very clear. Your future is the military. And it's actually a message being sent at an earlier and earlier age, as even elementary schools now get tanks for little kids to come and play on. But despite all of this pressure on students to sign up, recruitment is way down. And this is causing some degree of panic among the military brass and the politicians. The Army in particular is so far behind on its annual recruitment goal, they must exert what military officials call a monumental effort to avoid missing their goal for the first time since 1999. But it's not just the Army, it's the other branches, the National Guard, the Reserves. They're all facing shortfalls. And there are a number of reasons for plummeting recruitment, the most obvious being that over 1,700 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq and over 6,500 wounded. But I think the backdrop to the unwillingness to sign up is actually opposition to the war itself. And that has a tremendous impact on whether people consider the risk of dying or of having to kill another person to be worth it. And that's why recruitment is down among Black Americans most of all. The percentage of new recruits who are Black has dropped 40% since the year 2000, which is just tremendous. And clearly, in a country as racist as ours, that's not because Black Americans are the ones who have the best access to alternative job opportunities, but it is because Blacks disproportionately oppose the war. A report prepared for the military concluded, more African Americans identify having to fight for a cause they don't support as a barrier to military service. In the face of this falling recruitment, the military has become truly desperate. Recently, the Army ended its policy of automatically excluding recruits who lie about their qualifications in favor of considering their total value to the military. Recruiters are also being put under enormous pressure to meet their quotas at all costs, which has resulted in a spate of recruiter abuses. And it's not that there weren't abuses before. I met a woman a week ago doing counter-recruitment at a community college who almost joined the military after recruiters convinced her not to tell her mother about it and to lie about the fact that she has asthma. So recruiters have always lied, but the crisis in recruitment, I think, is both making it more common and also is opening up the space for those abuses to get national attention. And that's why on May 20th, after a Houston recruiter was recorded on tape telling a young man he would be arrested if he didn't show up at his recruiting station that day, the Army took the unprecedented step of holding a national values stand down. They halted all recruitment across the U.S. for the day to supposedly retrain recruiters in ethics and the law. And obviously, this is a PR move on the Army's part, but for us, it was an opportunity. So the Campus Anti-War Network and other groups called it as a national day of action and protested recruiting stations across the country. And that, I think, that's what has to be our model, to take their weakness and turn it into our strength, because we want recruitment to fail. The abuses and the lies and the poverty draft and also the treatment of soldiers in Iraq and when they come home reveal that what they are to the military is cannon fodder. Recruiters are taking advantage of the extreme economic and racial inequalities in our society to pull people into an institution where they face daily racism, sexism, a third of women in the military are sexually assaulted, homophobia in the form of the bigoted No Child Left Behind Act. And, I mean, these are all Oh, I'm sorry.
No child behind.
It's all bad, but it is the bigoted don't ask, don't tell. But you know, these are all reasons to oppose recruitment. I mean, it's disgusting. But most fundamentally, I think we have to oppose recruitment because the U.S. military is an institution dedicated to carrying out imperialism the whole world over. Its job is to get poor people from this country to kill poor people in other countries, all for the benefit of wealthy Americans who get richer and richer off of other people's oil. And the fact that they're having trouble recruiting people for that project is a victory for the entire world.
Campus anti-war network counter-recruitment activist Elizabeth Wrigley Field. Our next speaker is Katrina Yaw from San Francisco State University.
All right. As Elizabeth has pointed out, the brutality of the occupation and its cost here at home is fueling a resistance both here and in Iraq. As the military becomes increasingly desperate for new recruits, students, parents, community activists have turned to their attention to opposing the presence of military recruiters on campuses across the country. Although challenges to military recruitment have been going on for decades, there's been an upsurge in the number of protests and actions over the last several months that is developing into a new national movement. A major boost came for the counter-recruitment movement in November 2004 when a federal appeals court overturned the Solomon Amendment, a federal law that ties federal funding for schools to the presence of military recruiters on campuses. The court ruled that schools have a right to exclude recruiters if they have anti-discrimination policies, which luckily most do, under the auspices that they have a First Amendment right to ban recruiters because of their bigoted don't ask, don't tell policy. This opened the door for activists to demand that recruiters be barred from campuses around the country. The counter-recruitment movement gained national headlines when on January 20th, 2005, the day of Bush's second inauguration, students at Seattle Central Community College confronted military recruiters on their campus. A group of 50 swelled to over 300 as activists held a rally and an occupation of the recruiters' own table in order to prevent them from handing out literature. Recruiters had to be escorted off campus among chants of "Don't come back" as students pelted them and rained down their own literature over their heads. The victory at SCCC gave confidence to students around the country to confront military recruiters in similar protests around the country. And the next several months, a wave of similar actions happened on dozens of campuses across the country. In some cases, they represented the activism of a small group of dedicated students who were able to galvanize other students' anger behind them and help push people to confront military recruiters. In other cases, there were more spontaneous outbursts of anger against budget cuts and the war in general. I myself was involved with a similar demonstration on March 9th, 2005, in which activists of members of Students Against War at San Francisco State University, a member of the Campus Anti-War Network chapter, organized a demonstration against counter-recruiters. We rallied in the main plaza with about 200 students, marched up into our student center, and rallied in front of the recruiters' table, chanting them down for over 2 hours, and then held a peaceful sit-in where students talked about the war and don't ask, don't tell, and all everything they opposed about military recruiters. In the end, the recruiters were forced to leave over an hour early without a single recruit. High school students have also been a major driving force behind the counter-recruitment movement. They won major victories this semester for their rights to protest anti-recruitment views at high schools like Minneapolis's Kennedy High School and Tacoma's Foss High School. Students at a high school in Montclair, New Jersey, organized an opt-out campaign, resulting in 80% of high school students signing the opt-out form to combat the horrible No Child Left Behind Act. Students at a New York City public school in the Bronx spontaneously kicked off military recruiters, and in their words, just got a bunch of their friends together, swamped the recruiters' tables, and yelled, "We don't want you here," until they left. Parents have joined the choir voices demanding that military recruiters not have unlimited access to their children. A Department of Defense survey from last November, the latest that's been done, shows that only 25% of parents would recommend military service to their children. That's down from 42% in August 2003. A recruiter told the New York Times, "I had one father say, if he saw me on his doorstep, I better bring some protection with me." At Seattle Garfield High School, dozens packed a meeting of the Parent Students Association in May that voted against allowing military recruiters on campuses. Community activists have also been a major part of the counter-recruitment movement, helping to aid students who confront military recruiters. In San Francisco, I've been a part of the Calls Not Combat campaign, a ballot initiative that states that the city opposes military recruiters being able to use public school facilities for recruitment, and that the city should also find ways to alleviate the economic draft by funding scholarships and job training for low-income students. Okay, these are some of the more exciting developments in the counter-recruitment movement, but there are many more that I just frankly don't have time to talk about. They're from people, you know, parents tabling next to recruiters, people leafling out of recruiting stations, and just the acts of 17-year-olds who under intense pressure are starting to stand up to recruiters and be like, hell no, we're not going to your war. These are exciting examples, but unfortunately, most of these people actually don't even know about each other right now. But we are beginning to see the beginning of a coalescing of a national movement. As the movement has gained momentum, it has drawn attention from those wishing to crush student activism and opposition against the war. Hostile administrations have clamped down on the rights of students to free speech. Hadass and I have both personally faced the wrath of an unsympathetic administration as a result of counter-recruitment protests taking place at the City College of New York and San Francisco State University, respectively. At SFSU, the administration singled out three individuals as well as two student organizations for disciplinary actions and sanctions resulting in the March 9th peaceful protests on campus. The majority of those active in the counter-recruitment movement fully support traditional counter-recruitment methods, which usually include efforts to cut through the misinformation around recruitment by providing material to potential recruits. However, there has been much debate about engaging in more militant or confrontational counter-recruitment actions that attempt to disrupt recruitment efforts and remove recruiters altogether from campuses. As a relatively new movement, activists are faced with many questions about the way to most effectively challenge recruiters on their campuses. Many feel that we have a right to both oppose the policies of the military and the war in Iraq, but question whether recruiters have just as much right to be there as us. In order to build an effective counter-recruitment movement, we must not only oppose the most egregious abuses of military recruiters, but their right to set foot on high school and university campuses. We cannot limit ourselves to just talking to students about better options because, as Elizabeth has pointed out, for working class and student of youth, there really aren't that many better options for them. And being hired to kill poor people of color in Iraq or Afghanistan, I would say hardly counts as a career option. As already noted, the military's bigoted don't ask, don't tell policy gives students a legal right to insist that military recruiters not be allowed on campus. Therefore, when administrations refuse to uphold their own anti-discrimination policy, it falls on students to be the ones to do so. However, some activists still question whether the removal of recruiters is an infringing on recruiters' rights to free speech. This is not a new question for the counter-recruitment movement or for activists. Michael Letwin, who was a counter-recruitment activist at UMass Boston in the 1980s, took up this question when confronting then-hostile Chancellor Robert Corgan. People should know that Robert Corgan is also the current president of San Francisco State University and is behind the drive to punish me and several other students. Michael Letwin said, if organized crime set up a table to recruit assassins, would we defend the right to free speech? If heroin pushers recruited junkies, would crowds of angry students gather in their defense? Hardly. That type of speech is directly related to activity so obviously dangerous and wrong that no one defends them. Why then is Why then is military recruitment different? The military serves as the armed wing of big business and is actively encouraging racism and sexism. Its purpose is to suppress by murder popular movements, whether in Iraq or Vietnam, the non-white communities in the U.S., the unions, or the universities. As such, it is the most deadly and large-scale form of organized crime in the world today. It is legal, as was slavery over 100 years ago, only because those who make the laws, the corporations and their representatives, needed to survive. But like organized crime, heroin pushers, and slave traders, it has no right to organize anyone in its criminal activities. Legal or not, it must be stopped. It should also be pointed out that it is impossible at this point for the counter-recruitment movement to infringe on the free speech of the military. As Elizabeth has pointed out, the military has a budget of over $4 billion for counter-recruitment alone. Anyone who's turned on a TV, picked up a newspaper or magazine, ventured outside their home, I bet has seen an ad for some branch of the U.S. military. Not to mention the thousands of recruiters they send out to prowl malls, rock concerts, and low-income communities every day. There are also those who question whether confronting recruiters whether confrontational counter-recruitment protests are anti-recruiter or shooting the messenger. Military Family Speaks Out did not organizationally endorse the call on January 20th for protests around the value stand down, saying their emphasis on unscrupulous recruiters rather than a system of pressure for recruitment is very problematic. They claim that the demand stand up against predatory recruiters focused on recruiters themselves rather than the system of recruitment that recruitment fostered by today's military. As socialists, we of course agree that lies recruiters tell are ultimately rooted in a system that requires working class people and people of color to die and kill for empire. And exposing this should be a major focus of the counter-recruitment movement. However, just as we oppose the war crimes of U.S. troops in Iraq, we must oppose the lies of military recruiters at home. Both are acting at the behest of the Pentagon, and both are cannon fodder. But that doesn't mean that we should not oppose their actions at the behest of the Pentagon. In fact, protest is the only way to win them to our side, and that's evident from the Vietnam War movement. The question of whether activists confront recruiters is related to the question of what demand should be put forward by the counter-recruitment movement. There have been questions about whether we should delimit our slogans to denouncing the don't ask, don't tell policy or the lies recruiters tell and not muddy the message by talking about the war. This leads activists down the slippery slope of letting others limit the terms of debate for the counter-recruitment movement. Our goal is not just to oppose the worst abuses of military recruitment or try to make a more effective army, but to combat the whole framework that is used to justify U.S. imperialism. The growing anger against the occupation is the driving force behind the crisis in the military, as well as the counter-recruitment movement. Taking on the issue of the war helps give people the confidence to continue to resist. The counter-recruitment movement is in its infancy, and I am confident because of its ability to both tap into hatred of the war and produce tangible results, it will continue to both grow and bring in a whole new layer of activists.
That was Katrina Yaw, campus counter-recruitment activist. The Campus Anti-War Network has called for a mobilization September 24th in Washington, D.C. For more information on the group and its anti-war activities, visit the website of the Trap Rock Peace Center, www.traprockpeace.org, traprockpeace.org. Thanks to Charlie Jenks for that recording. And you can contact us through our website on welcomeguests.org, where MP3s of this and previous shows are available for download. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Welcome.